Hello and welcome to Mind in Kingston's podcast, where we talk about all things mental health with people who live or work in the borough. I'm Vicky Bourne and I work as the charity's counselling and wellbeing coordinator. In this edition.
I'm curious about people's stories. I can't stop researching. I can't stop just asking people questions about their lives and just sort of seeing where that goes.
Kingston resident Chris Cleave is a novelist. These days he's also training to be a psychotherapist. His last novel, Everyone Brave is Forgiven, was an instant New York Times bestseller when it was published in 2017. And his other novels, Incendiary, The Other Hand and Gold, have also topped bestseller lists around the world. But then his writing is regularly praised for its psychological insights. But he started out thinking he was going to study chemistry at university.
I began doing chemistry, discovered I really wasn't very good at it, and my brain didn't go fast enough, especially in the maths. And I changed to psychology, which suited me a lot better. And I've really stayed in that kind of vein ever since, just being interested in people and trying to understand their experiences.
Which, of course, comes across very strongly in all of your books. And your first book, Incendiary, I believe, was about a terrorist attack and actually, strangely, had the same coincidental publication date as 7/7. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. That was just a really eerie coincidence.
Yeah, it must have been very difficult.
Yeah, I think so. It was harder for the people who were really caught up in that attack and, you know, for the victims. So I don't feel that it was particularly hard for me, but I do feel that it was particularly strange for me. So I had, you know, my whole life really was invested in my work at that point. I research all my books a lot, you know, so I spend a lot of time with the kinds of people that I'm going to write about, and I interview them and I hang out with them. And I'd been really interested in the victims of terror attacks. You know, because often the way these things are reported, they are horrific attacks and people concentrate on the action of those attacks. And then the people who've become victims, who are injured or bereaved, they kind of fall out of the news and people stop caring about them. And I've thought that they had a story that was worth telling. So Incendiary is the story of someone who's been violently bereaved, and that's a story that tries to imagine the world of someone who's lost so much and how they manage to rebuild themselves and how they find meaning and hope again. And, you know, no one's ever fixed, but how this person learns to live with that. What was hard for me in 7/7 was the fact that I had just gone through a pretty long process of trying to understand what the victims of things like that go through. And so it was just very sad, just thinking, you know, that as soon as an attack like that happens, a great sort of political movement begins and everyone's looking for, you know, who to blame, how to fight back, what to do. I guess I'm not really in that headspace. I'm in that space of like, well, how can people live who've been caught up in it? And who's there to look after them? How are they going to look after themselves? You know, I think that's a deep story, and it isn't one that gets told much.
I've read that you went into quite a dark place after writing that book, and I was wondering what got you back to wanting to write another one after that.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I was really upset by 7/7. You know, I felt that I'd written about this thing that really felt as if it had, you know, had come to pass, and that this line between, you know, fiction and reality had become very blurred for me anyway. The reaction to that book was pretty difficult, actually. Bizarrely, it went into the shops on the morning of the 7th of July 2005, and it came off sale that same day. You know, it was taken out of the shops because people thought, you know, that
it was seen as inappropriate.
That it was inappropriate, yeah. Mm. So, like, at the time, I agreed with that decision. I thought, yeah, this isn't about me. This is about the victims. It's about the people who've really died, and their true story is now more relevant and more important than mine. So I supported the decision, actually, to take the book off sale. But I now look back at that and I think that was probably a manifestation of my own shock, actually. Because
a lot to process.
Yeah.
An awful lot.
Because it's not a book that glorifies terrorism. It's not a book that celebrates those acts. Just the opposite, actually. It's quite a gentle book that looks at the lives of people who've been bereaved. Mm. And I'm still proud of the book. I don't think there's much wrong with it.
Of course.
And so,
and I'm sure could be very helpful to people in that situation, possibly, as well.
Maybe. I don't know. I hope so. But in the great sort of mix of what happened, you know, I felt that, I don't know, somehow my book had become toxic in a way that didn't feel right, actually. It didn't feel that it had done justice to the book that it was. And and so I went into quite a dark place and thought, you know, this is the thing I do as a writer. And I felt quite sort of shut down by that. And I didn't really know how to come back from it. So I wondered for a long time if I wanted to be a writer or if I would maybe do something else. And what brought me out of it was people again. I'm curious about people's stories. I can't stop researching. I can't stop just asking people questions about their lives and just sort of seeing where that goes. So then, you know, I got really interested in stories about refugees. You know, at that point, there was, as there always is, I think, in the UK, like a continuing rolling debate about what kind of a country we want to be, whether we want to be an open country or a closed country, you know, whether our interest is always a self-interest or whether it extends to, you know, helping other people. Or, you know.
And I think you're right, there was particularly a big debate going on at that time, wasn't there?
Yeah, 2005, 2006, 2007... It got furiously heated. There were lots of people coming to the UK, a lot of them from sub-Saharan Africa, a lot of them from the Balkans. A lot of people wanted to help, a lot of people wanted to keep them out. And like always, I don't really get involved in the politics, but I'm really interested in the people. So I started telling this story, yeah. Of like, here's, you know, and it ended up being the story of a refugee from Nigeria and a woman from Kingston who, you know, was quite similar to people I know around here. I mean, I live in Kingston. And so this became a story with two narrators trying to see both sides of that immigration question, but as a story, you know, rather than as a sort of political statement. And that's the story that got me out of my depression, I think.
Yeah. And it was a book that had a big impact at the time, didn't it? And it did really well.
A lot of people read it.
I read it for my book group along with many other thousands of people, I'm sure.
Thanks very much. Thanks for reading it. I'm grateful for the reception it got because it did seem to give people a way to start thinking about what it would be like to be a refugee. You know, I just wanted to think, you know, in my life, what would it be like if this happened to me? I don't think we're ever far away actually from becoming destitute ourselves and from needing someone to just temporarily, you know, pick us up. I wanted it to sort of ask that question gently of the reader and then let the reader find their own way through. And, you know, and people will come to that book with their own politics and their own ideas, and which I'm not trying to change at all. I'm just trying to make the story always about people rather than about ideas, I think.
Because you referred to earlier, you know, about trying to employ a kind of method type of writing, and you often go and try and live the lives that you're writing around. Well, you can't do that exactly, but as near as you can. So is that something that that you were doing for that book particularly or for future books?
Yeah, the refugee book was really interesting because, you know, living in London, southwest London, there's a lot of refugees. You don't have to travel around the whole world to find those stories. You just have to travel down the street. So there are refugee charities in Kingston that were helpful to me. There were various different refugee organisations in London. I just went and talked. And what's quite interesting as a novelist, as a storyteller, is that if you just say to people, you know, I'm interested in your life, I'm writing a book around this kind of area, would you like to tell me whatever you would like to tell me about your life and your experience. People are amazingly helpful. If you come without much of an agenda, you don't really want anything from them, but you are interested in their lives, people, I have found, will talk and will spend time with you. And actually, when I'm talking with people, what I mostly am interested in is not so much the details of exactly what's happened, but I'm interested in their voice and the way they talk about those things. You know, whether their voice is sort of active or passive, whether they're sort of happening to the world or whether it feels to them as if the world is happening to them. Who they talk to, what they dream about.
So really matters. Trying to get inside their heads as much as you can.
Yeah, or to give them the space to express that, to give them a space where they can talk about who they are and how their life feels, rather than just trying to reduce them to a series of facts, you know, like this happened, then that happened. And so then when I come to the page, what I'm trying to do is just do justice to them as people. I guess try to show the stuff that they go through, like in their inner world, because I think that's the stuff that we can all relate to. I haven't had the experience of being a refugee. I haven't had the experience of being traumatically bereaved. But my inner world, you know, my world of dreaming and being with people and feeling what it is to be in this life does have a connection with theirs. And it does have a connection with the reader's mind. Because at this really deep level, I think we're connected. That's the level I try to write at.
Yeah, and I think that really comes across. And you've also written about cyclists. That was a very different book, wasn't it?
yeah, it was a crazy book. So I decided that it was bad for me to spend so much time in these very dark places. You know, so I'd spent 4 years writing and researching traumatic bereavement and then another chunk of time writing and researching refugees and refugee stories, which always have an element of displacement and trauma. And you know, however well refugees are doing, it's rarely people's first choice. Yeah. I mean, it takes a lot to make someone think, right, it's so dangerous here that I must now move and move my family and go to somewhere less dangerous. I felt that darkness starting to weigh on me and to change who I was. So I decided I would do something completely different. And because I'm always attracted to people who live at the extremes of life, I thought I would go and talk to people who'd chosen to be at an extreme rather than had just found themselves at an extreme, hence Olympians.
Yeah. It was going on at the time, I imagine.
Yeah.
Because we saw a lot of the cyclists in Kingston, didn't we?
Yeah.
2012.
That's right. I wrote it for the 2012 Olympics because it felt to me that, you know, this was the greatest show on earth and it was coming to my hometown and I wanted to write about it. And I'm really pleased I did. I enjoyed it a lot. Yeah. I met some really amazing people. Like, these athletes.
And took up cycling yourself, I believe.
I did, yeah. So I did my whole method acting thing. Got a bike, got a cycling coach for a bit. And
wow.
Because, okay, so I can't obviously be as fast or as powerful as an Olympian. But what I found that I could do was, you know, try to train for as many hours as they did and see what that did to my mind and body.
And what did it do?
It just broke me.
That's interesting.
Yeah, what I realised is that they're extremely physically gifted and that's the sort of entry level to being them. But what really separates the champions is a calm, patient, fierce determination and a will to put in the work, you know, even when it's cold and wet and rainy and they're exhausted and it's Friday night and everyone else is going out to the pub, they're going to go to the track.
Yeah, and it's that single track focus.
Yeah, I really admired them, actually, and found them very inspiring to be around and realised that I could never be them. And writing about that obsession and that determination was interesting because it makes us think about, okay, so what is it that we really want in our lives? What would we fight for? You know, what will we put everything on the line for?
Because it was about making choices too, wasn't it, in that book, between success and personal life, really. So
yeah, and I think that's something that we all have to do. We all have to find that balance. And it was quite interesting, like, talking about people who make the decision not to have the balance at all, you know, who say, right, I'm going to put absolutely everything into my career as an athlete and I'll pick up the pieces later. So it was an interesting story to tell about, okay, well, what do those pieces look like and how do you pick them up? And it felt quite, when that ended up actually in a weird way being quite a dark book too, you know, because it looked at the flip side of these great successes that we see. We live in a culture that really celebrates the individual and the glory and the heroism of these astonishing acts and things that people do that are brave and are exceptional. And we're not very quick to praise people as heroes who live a balanced and quiet life. You know, my experience of talking with people now for, you know, 20 years, I guess, about this kind of thing, is that actually those people are heroic. You know, it is brave. And it's very, very difficult to live a helpful, useful, balanced life. Yeah, yeah. As a society, it feels like we don't have a grip on how to tell those stories in a way that we admire those people.
Although you did try and tell that story through your book, Everyone is Brave, going back to the wartime generation, and you compare that generation to maybe, as you say, much more of a cult of individualism that we're living in now, and obviously a lot of unsung heroes and heroines at that time. And in your book, you paid tribute to how they found a way of really pulling together, you know, at a very challenging period in history. And obviously that's something we've seen a little of this year, to some extent, and I wondered whether that had heartened you in some way, had given you more cause for optimism.
Yeah, I'd say definitely. So I've seen some stuff in this year, in 2020, that has been superb. So much to admire in people, I think. I don't know if we're the same country now as the country that fought in the war and that endured those things. And my book, Everyone Brave is Forgiven, talks about, you know, what bravery means. And I've come to change my idea about what bravery is since I wrote that book, actually. I think that we now live in a world that's very connected, and we live in a world where our relationships with our neighbours, with each other, are extremely important, very strong, very complex. And we live in a world with limited resources, where the environment is under threat a little bit. And so maybe heroism now is living a bit quietly. Maybe heroism is like using less so that other people can have space and resources. Maybe heroism is being not quite so individualistic and just trying to find a little balance and taking half a step back and letting those relationships between us and other people be more important than ourselves. And that's not to say that we can't be important. We can, but if our relationships with other people are the most important part of us, then that feels like quite a heroic thing, quite a brave way to be. At its best, that's what I've seen in 2020. Some amazing things have come out of my local community in Kingston. You know, people in my road, we all know each other now. Whereas a year ago, I knew a few faces. Now we know each other. You know, we know the houses where people are really having to self-isolate. You know, we are making sure that they get to eat.
Leading on from that, I understand that you had COVID earlier in the year and it's left you with some after effects as well.
Yeah.
And I wondered how that was and how you're feeling now.
Oh, I'm all right. Thanks for asking. I don't know if you noticed, but I'm breathing a bit. Like, my breathing is a bit difficult still. But I'm... The first couple of months were really hard. So I got COVID in March and I was lucky, I didn't have to be hospitalised. And the hardest thing for me was the recovery. I had months where it was just honestly like being shot with a tranquilizer dart. It was like wherever I was in the house, I just had to lie down there. You know, I couldn't even go upstairs. And then I would wake up like either 20 minutes later or 4 hours later, you know, just dozing. And it felt like I'd... I don't know, it was a very sort of, I'm going to call it a really deep convalescence.
But sounds like long COVID or many of the description that many people have given.
Yeah. So now, for example, that only happens like once a month, I'd say, you know, like one day a month, whereas it used to happen like 3 or 4 days a week, you know, so it's getting better all the time. And I'm not trying to frighten people here, but the, you know, I've been lucky. I have got a lot better, and I've heard from people, you know, I follow this long COVID support group now. I mean, there's a lot of people who are much worse off, so I don't really have much to complain about. Yeah, it was real, you know, and you know, my thoughts really go out to people who are suffering with this, because it's a bit of a game changer.
So have you managed to get back on your bike at all? Is that...
I do a bit. I'm so slow, honestly. Like, I was pretty fit before COVID. Not sort of crazily fit, but you know, I could get on my bike and ride it pretty fast. And now I just get out of breath and I'm slowly working my way back to it, I think. The whole thing, it hasn't been a really negative experience for me. I mean, I think I've been quite lucky, and because I'm a writer, I can carry on working, and that's a big deal. I've found a lot that's really positive in the experience. I mean, it's like losing my physical health has sort of forced me to look at myself in a different way and think, well, okay, who am I now and what can I still do? And I've been trying to live in the space that is available to me now rather than hope it's all going to come back the way it was. You know, and I've found that I'm really lucky because there's still a lot of space there.
So it's been time to take stock and have a bit of a rest by the sound of it. And I gather you're also training to be a psychotherapist.
Yeah, I am.
And so that sounds a bit like the culmination of trying to answer some of the questions about the human condition that you've been asking in many of your books.
I think there's a lot of continuity between sort of researching people in novels and I'm working with people as a therapist. But there's a lot that's different as well. I mean, being a therapist is much more being there for people and being there to sort of facilitate their own growth and their own development and to help them, you know, work through their own stuff. The bit that's really different from being a novelist is I'm not trying to interpret their lives or explain their lives or tell a story. I'm trying to very much let them tell their own. I mean, that's my real emphasis as a therapist, is to let people sort of take back their own stories and find their own meaning in that. What's similar between those two bits of work, you know, the bit working as a novelist and working as a therapist, what's really similar is a kind of curiosity about people, a genuine sort of openness to trying to understand what it's like to be them. And what's different is, I think when you're a therapist, you come with much less of an agenda. I don't have a story to write here. I have a person to be there for. I'm really loving the work. I'm loving the training. It is a real privilege to do the work. You know, I'm in my first clinical year now. To start working with clients has been really interesting. And a real privilege to work with these people who are engaging with that process and very positively working through things that they bring and that they want to talk about. I'm at a really early stage. I'm learning every day. And I'm finding that this is, you know, the kind of person I want to be now. I can't now see myself not being a therapist. You know, I'll probably carry on writing, but this feels like, you know, the person that I've been becoming all this time.
Yes, like the kind of what it's all been leading up to. And it is, as you say, such a privilege to hear people's stories. That's something that I share, and it's been such a privilege to talk to you today, Chris. So thank you so much for taking part in our podcast.
Well, thank you.
I was speaking there to Kingston resident and author Chris Cleave. Before we go, do check out the other chats in this series. You can find them where you usually download your podcasts, and we'd be grateful if you subscribed and left a review too to help spread the word. We're here to help after all. I'm Vicky Bourne of Mind in Kingston, and until the next time, take good care.